pressed a taser against his jugular and said, "This." Chapter 47. Boston, Massachusetts. Harvath and the old man spoke for more than 2 hours. He had gone through everything that had happened since he had arrived in Boston, and then the old man had asked him to repeat it, twice. He asked question after question, and expected Harvath to drill down to even the minutest details. When they were done talking, Harvath not only needed aspirin, he also needed a drink, and he helped himself to a glass, some ice, and 2 bottles of bourbon from the minibar. Even that, though, wasn't enough to help him unwind. He thought about turning on the TV, but he knew it would only keep him up for hours. He also knew that pouring another drink wasn't the right path. He might get a couple of hours of sleep, but it wouldn't be quality sleep. Instead, he fished out one of the books Bill Wise had given to him, and which he had tossed in his overnight bag on the way out of his house yesterday. The reading did the trick, and he soon found his eyes growing heavy. As soon as he couldn't keep them open any longer, he tossed the book aside, turned out the light, and fell asleep. Much like the night before, he felt like he had just drifted off when his cell phone rang. He snatched his kobold off the nightstand and looked at the time. It was just after 3 a.m. It was Cordero.
"The killer struck again," she said.
"Wait, what?"
Harvath replied, as he tried to shake off the cobwebs.
"Where? Boston?
North End. Close to where we ate dinner. I'm already in the car. Be downstairs in 15 minutes.
Harvath was downstairs in 10, and Cordero showed up a minute and a half later.
"Tell me what happened," he said,
as he got into the car and Cordero sped away from the hotel.
"Apparently, another elaborate scene like the Liberty Tree building."
"Who was it?"
"We don't have an ID on the victim yet," said Cordero,
as she weaved through the sparse traffic, her lights blazing and klaxon blaring.
"They're saying it could take a while."
"Why?"
"A lot of his flesh is missing. It sounds like he was boiled to death."
"Boiled to death?" Harvath replied.
"That's what Sal said. He told me I'd see for myself once I got there."
"Who found him?"
"Fire department, apparently. The killer used a timer of some sort to start a controlled fire with lots of smoke. It didn't do any real damage, but it scared a lot of folks. The guy lit a tire in the bathtub or something."
If you want to get someone's attention, that is the way to do it. Tires burned with thick, acrid black smoke. Harvath had seen more than his share of tire fires across third world countries. It was a smell you never forgot, and one he absolutely hated.
"The ME is going to need dental records from the 2 males on your missing persons list," said Cordero.
"Being boiled to death is pretty unusual. So is a timed tire fire. But how can you be sure this is our killer?"
"Because,"
she replied, as she swerved and narrowly missed a car that had slammed on its brakes, rather than pulling over to allow her to pass,
"the killer left a note, along with a picture."
"Of a skull and bones with a crown floating above."
"Yep."
"Do you know anything about the address we're going to? Any reason why it might be significant?"
Cordero shook her head.
"No. It's not one of the ones we passed last night, I know that."
"Do you know anything about the area at all?"
"It's near the intersection of Fleet Street and Garden Court. I think that's the neighborhood where JFK's mother was born, or grew up, or something."
Or something. If that was the case, it didn't make any sense. What would Rose Kennedy have to do with a vendetta against the Fed? And why would the killer switch tactics like that all of a sudden? It had to be something else. When they arrived, narrow Garden Court was blocked off at each end by police cruisers, and all of the buildings up and down the street were awash in the glow of emergency vehicle lights.
"We'll end up getting blocked in if I try to get any closer," Cordero said. "Let's park here."
Harvath agreed, and after parking her car, they got out to walk the rest of the way.
"Did you get any sleep?" he asked, as they made their way to the scene.
"A little. How about you?"
"Not nearly enough, but I'll be okay."
"We'll get coffee after," she promised.
Because it was a one-way street with parking only on one side, most of the responding vehicles had parked on the west side, many of them all the way up on the sidewalks, so as not to block through traffic for the fire trucks. Harvath and Cordero walked on the opposite side. As they drew parallel with their destination,
Harvath noticed a plastic plaque on the building next to Cordero.
"You were right," he said. "Look."
The female detective skimmed the historical marker.
"How about that? I know some Boston history after all."
4 Garden Court Street, home of John J. Honeyfitz Fitzgerald, Boston mayor, and birthplace of daughter Rose Fitzgerald, mother of American President John F. Kennedy. As they slipped between 2 parked cars and around a fire truck idling in the middle of the street, Harvath tried to process what the Kennedy connection could be. That train of thought, though, came to an immediate halt when they arrived in front of 5 Garden Court Street, which had an even more dramatic plaque, this one from weathered bronze, announcing the building's, or more appropriately, the site's, historical significance.
"Here stood the mansion of Governor Thomas Hutchinson," Harvath read aloud, as he typed the man's name into the web browser on his phone.
"Who was he?" Cordero asked.
"Apparently, one of Boston's most hated citizens, brother-in-law to Andrew Oliver, the man they hung in effigy from the Liberty Tree. Hutchinson was also the last royal governor of Massachusetts before the Revolutionary War. It says here that Sam Adams couldn't stand him. For many of the colonists, Hutchinson represented everything that they believed was wrong with Britain. He was greedy, arrogant, and a pretty big snob. A couple of weeks after the Liberty Tree incident, angry Bostonians looted and tore Hutchinson's house apart."
"Didn't Hutchinson have something to do with the Boston Tea Party?"
Harvath scrolled further down on his screen and nodded. "When the colonists wanted to send a large shipment of tea back to England to protest the tea tax, Hutchinson intervened. When word leaked that he was the secret distributor for the tea, people went berserk. There were citywide protests, which grew in scope and anger until culminating in
the Boston Tea Party."
"Bingo," said Harvath. "He left not long after and died in exile in England."
"So he wasn't killed in Boston? Never boiled to death?"
"No, not according to this," he said,
as he slid the phone back into his pocket.
"But that doesn't mean there isn't some sort of connection to whatever it is we're about to see."
"Are you ready to go in?" she asked.
Harvath wasn't even near the front door, and already he could smell the horrible odor of burnt tire. Taking a last breath of semi-fresh air, he nodded and followed her inside.
Chapter 48.
The smell of a burnt tire was worse than driving behind a bubbling asphalt truck. The smoke had left black streaks up the front of the building, from where it had escaped out the front door and where the firemen had smashed the front windows. Inside, you could trace the smoke's path along the upper walls and ceiling straight back to the bathroom. Unless there was something terribly interesting he had to see in there, he'd put off ground zero for the tire burning for as long as he could. What he was most interested in was the victim. He followed Cordero into the living room. Her partner was there waiting, smug as usual, and looking fresh as a daisy, with his hair combed, face shaved, and shoe shined. He'd probably gotten a great night's sleep as well.
"Looks like you were wrong about the killer's next stop being Fort Hill," he said.
"Let's not start, Sal," said Cordero. "Okay?
I'm just saying, our golden boy here isn't right about everything."
"Why don't you sit down and give your mind a rest, Sal?" Harvath said as he brushed past him.
Cordero joined him in the living room.
"Can we not do this, please?" she asked quietly.
"Without looking at the body, how do you expect to figure anything out?"
She cut him a look and tilted her head toward her partner in the entry hall.
"You know what I'm talking about."
"I'll try,"
Harvath replied as he approached the gang box. As he got closer, he began to pick up another scent. Cordero could smell it, too.
"What is that?"
"Pine."
"Like pine saw?"
Harvath shook his head as he noticed a couple of stray feathers near the gang box.
"Pine tar."
"What is—"
she began, but stopped when she looked into the box and saw the horrific state of the body. Harvath stood next to her and looked at the corpse as well. For several seconds, neither said anything. Then he stated,
"Pine tar was used in the colonies to preserve wood on sailing ships and to weatherize rope. It was also used for a form of physically and emotionally painful public humiliation called tarring and feathering."
As seasoned as she was to death and murder,
This one was particularly rough to look at.
Do you think he died from the tarring and feathering? Or from having his head shackled to the bottom of the box and having it filled up with pine tar?
Feel it, she said, reaching her hand out to touch the metal. It's still warm. Harvath didn't need to feel it. He would take her word for it. What he was interested in was the message, painted in red on the underside of the lid. In addition to the crossed bones with the skull and crown hovering above, was a sentence which read, "How strangely will the tools of a tyrant pervert the plain meaning of words." Beneath it were the letters S-O-L.
"Any idea what that phrase means?" she asked.
Harvath was unaware of its historical context, but he had a pretty good idea of why it had been chosen by the killer. Bill Wise had mentioned something about how the Fed purposefully obfuscated what they did in order to divert attention. If he had to bet, that was what he'd put his money on. As far as who said it, he had no idea. "Sam Adams," said Cordero's partner, who had come into the living room to join them. He held out his smartphone and read, "From a letter to John Pitts, January 21st, 1776. She couldn't tell if Harvath was warming up another jibe or not, but she decided to circumvent it and keep the conversation focused.
"What do we know about the victim?" she asked.
Harvath had already identified him, but he wasn't about to spill that information to anyone but Cordero, and it would be done in private. "Right now," replied the male detective, "we don't have anything. He's a John Doe. We'll see what the ME gets prints-wise, and if they turn up anything. If there's nothing on file for this guy, we'll have to attempt dental records, and maybe facial reconstruction."
"How about the fire?" asked Harvath. "Any clues there?"
The man shrugged. "Go ask the arson investigators. They're back in the bathroom." Harvath figured Sal had already gleaned a preliminary report from them, and could have easily filled him in, but he had promised Cordero he'd try to go easy on him. Walking to the bathroom, he stopped just short of the doorway. The lingering odor was terrible.
"What do you guys have?" he asked.
"Who are you?" one of the investigators asked tersely.
"Emily Dickinson," he replied just as tersely,
sensing that was about the only thing this guy was going to respect.
"Now tell me what you've got."
His partner held up a plastic evidence bag with what looked like a charred and half-melted circuit board. "Pretty simple setup, a timer and an igniter. Left it sitting on top of the tire. Tire was soaked with gasoline or kerosene. Consensus right now is that he wanted to send a smoke signal, not burn the building down."
"Think you'll be able to trace those parts?"
"Maybe, but they look rather basic. Could have come from anywhere. I wouldn't hold my breath if I were you." That was exactly what Harvath was doing, and he needed some fresh air. Passing through the apartment, he signaled for Cordero to join him. Outside, he stepped away from the building and took in a couple of deep breaths.
"You all right?" she asked.
"I'm fine. I just hate that smell."
She wrinkled up her nose.
"It is pretty awful. Why'd you want me to follow you out here?"
"I think I know who the victim is."
"You do? How? A huge part of that poor guy's face was melted off and he's covered in feathers."
"It's Peter Whalen from Chicago," said Harvath.
"In the file I have on him, it describes him as being 5'5". The other missing man, Renner, is 6'2". You wouldn't have been able to fit a 6'2" man in that box unless you sawed him in half. Make sure to tell the ME to look for scars on the victim's knees once they get all the tarn feathers cleaned off. Whalen was a skier. He'd blown both his knees and had to have them repaired back before the surgery got a lot less invasive. The scars should be pretty obvious."
"I'll let them know." He took a deep breath and said,
"This means there's only two left now."
Cordero nodded.
"Do you think the killer plans to do them both here in Boston?"
Leaning against the side of a police cruiser that had been parked up on the sidewalk, he tried to think.
"I honestly don't know," he said.
"Whalen went missing in Chicago, right?"
"Right."
"Well, if the killer brought Whalen here, why not the others?"
It was a good question, except for the fact that all five missing candidates had been grabbed on the same night, which meant there had to have been teams involved. At least one of those teams had brought Peter Whalen from Chicago to Boston. Had the others been brought here too? Anything was possible.
"The remaining two could be here," said Harvath, "I suppose."
You've had one murder in Georgia, and two now, unfortunately, in Boston. I'd say, just numbers-wise, Boston is your best bet.
So, what do you suggest?
First, coffee, said Cordero.
And then what?
And then, we try to figure out where the killer is keeping the remaining two, and get to them before he can kill again.
Chapter 49. Washington, District of Columbia.
Go easy on him, said Wise, as he watched them secure the CIA operative. You don't have to hurt him.
Bob McGee looked up at the man like he was nuts.
In case you missed what just happened, Mahatma, this guy wasn't here for yoga class. He came to kill you. In fact, he came here to torture you and then kill you. Why are you so bent out of shape about how tight I put the cuffs on him?
Because I know Samuel, and I want you to treat him with respect.
McGee shook his head.
This is a big boy. We're trussing him up tight. After that, you can show him all the respect you want. Fair enough?
Wise knew there was no point in arguing. In fact, he wanted McGee to restrain Samuel as tightly as possible. If he didn't, and the man got loose, they'd all be in trouble. What's more, by petitioning for kind treatment, Wise was already conditioning Samuel for interrogation. The gruffer and more inconsiderate of Samuel that McGee was, the more it played into Wise's plan.
There, said McGee, as he stood back and admired his handiwork. This fella ain't going anywhere anytime soon, are you?
Samuel did not reply.
Wise looked at Ryan and said, You can lower your weapon now.
Ryan looked at McGee, who nodded, at which point she aimed the muzzle of her weapon down, but didn't put it away. Samuel had been secured to a support column and was facing away from the living area. Wise brought over a pair of shooting muffs. Showing them to Samuel, he said,
This is only going to be for a few minutes while we discuss what we're going to do. May I?
Samuel nodded, and Wise slipped the muffs over the man's large head. They almost didn't fit. When he had them in place, he laid his hand on Samuel's shoulder for a moment and then walked away to join the others. They gathered on the other side of the glass display case with the sewing machines and the typewriters. It was not only an additional sound barrier, it also allowed them to keep Samuel in their sight. McGee was the first one to speak.
Why are you so deferential to that guy? Do you have any idea who he is? What he does?
Of course I do. I trained him.
Wait, what?
Maybe trained is the wrong word, said Wise.
Samuel was under my tutelage for a time.
McGee looked at Ryan. I told you I knew who this guy was. Looking back at Wise, he stated,
You're that guy from the agency they called Dr. Kill. Some of our people in the Special Activities Division worked with you on a couple of your projects.
Can we back up for a second? Can you please better explain who you both are and what you're doing here?
In the chaos of taking down Samuel, getting him secure, and helping a dazed Bill Wise to his feet, there hadn't been time for introductions. Ryan stepped forward and did so now. It was a bit of an intellectual standoff. Ryan and McGee wanted more information about why Wise had been made a target, while Wise felt he was owed the same explanation from Ryan and McGee. You are in my house, battled against, if it wasn't for us, he would have killed you. In the end, it was Wise who finally conceded. To his credit, though, he didn't give them everything. A good operative always kept a little bit in reserve, just in case.
I've heard of Swim Club, said McGee. Past tense, though. I thought it had been shut down.
Seems like there's been a lot of that going on at Langley, Ryan stated.
That piqued Wise's interest, and he raised his eyebrows in response. But McGee had a couple more questions first.
So, Samuel passed from your program into Swim Club?
That's my assumption. I think he'll tell me if I ask.
Why?
Because I know him, and he sees himself as a good man. Honor is important to him.
McGee shook his head.
A psychopath with honor? That's a first for me.
Samuel may possess a certain moral flexibility, but he is not a psychopathic personality. He's actually quite gentle most of the time. In fact, that's why they took to calling him the Lamb. That's the Lamb? Samuel? He's that Lamb?
You've heard of him? Asked Ryan.
Yeah, I've heard of him. I'd never met him, but some of our people have used him. The guy's a legend, and not in a good way. In a Hannibal Lecter sort of way.
He eats people?
No, he's just a stone-cold killer, said McGee. Somebody you send in to do very difficult or very disagreeable wet work. There was another guy we used whose nickname was the Axe Murderer, and there were things even he wouldn't do. The Lamb, though, came through every time, no matter what. So imagine, said Wise, how interested I must be to find out why you followed Samuel here. The ball was now in their court, and Ryan did the talking. While she was generous with her information, she wasn't completely generous. Like Wise, she understood that it was smart to keep a little bit in reserve. She walked him through everything, beginning with her surprise meeting with a foreign intelligence official, all the way up to how they had found Samuel, and decided to follow him when he engaged in a sudden shift change. When she was done, Wise had almost the same question for her that she had asked upon her rescue by McGee.
What took you so long to step in? Why didn't you intervene sooner?
We were trying to pick the right moment, Ryan replied.
She was trying to pick the right moment, McGee offered. I was trying to decide which of you I was going to shoot. And I assume you wanted to hear some of my interrogation, said Wise. That too.
Speaking of which, interjected Ryan, I'd like to take a crack at Samuel. I have a lot of questions I want answered.
It sounds like we both do. McGee cleared his throat. Make that three.
Wise nodded.
You'll find Samuel much different than what you're used to. He's highly intelligent, and if he can play you, he will. He also appreciates being treated with courtesy. Respect is a significant issue with him. He only has one true loyalty, and it trumps anything at the agency, so we should attempt to leverage that to our advantage.
Why don't I take second chair and let you run the show, said Ryan.
I think that would be best. If we handle this properly, it can be quick and smooth. And if we don't handle it properly, asked McGee, then you may wish you had your friend the Axe Murderer here instead.
Chapter 50
I'm sorry if wearing these was uncomfortable at all, Samuel, Wise said, as he removed the shooting muffs from the man's head and sat across from him. He was relaxed and spoke calmly, almost soothingly.
It wasn't uncomfortable, Dr. Wise, but thank you for saying so.
Samuel, do you recognize this gentleman and this lady? He asked, gesturing to Ryan and McGee.
Yes, doctor. The lady is Ms. Lydia Ryan, and the gentleman is Mr. Robert McGee. Both are employees of the Central Intelligence Agency.
As are you, correct?
No, sir.
Excuse me?
It is not correct that I work for the Central Intelligence Agency.
Wise looked at him for a moment and then rephrased. You work for a black program funded by the Central Intelligence Agency, which allows them to disavow you if you are caught or captured.
That is correct.
Samuel, do you recognize the position you are now in?
I have been restrained by you, Dr. Wise, a former CIA employee, as well as Ms. Ryan and Mr. McGee, current CIA employees.
Correct. And do you recognize that what happens to you going forward will be entirely based upon the degree to which you cooperate with us?
I have been cooperative, Samuel said.
Wise got back to his original question. Please tell me how it is that you were able to identify Ms. Ryan and Mr. McGee to me.
They were both targets I was tasked with terminating.
And who gave you that tasking?
The man was silent and didn't respond.
Samuel, Wise prodded, that is a direct question, and I expect an answer, please.
The man remained quiet.
Samuel,
This is very serious, and it goes far beyond you targeting fellow agents or even coming after me.
Nothing.
Wise removed his phone.
I'm sorry to have to do this.
The bald-headed man was suddenly agitated.
Who are you calling, Dr. Wise?
You know who I'm calling, Samuel.
Dr. Wise, I strongly recommend you stop. Now.
I'm sorry, Samuel. This is beyond my control.
Stop!
He shouted. But as quickly as he had lost his temper, he brought it back under control.
Please hang up the phone, Dr. Wise.
Wise looked at him as he put down the phone.
Your sister still doesn't know, does she?
Samuel's face reddened. Though whether from anger or shame, it was not immediately clear.
Wise looked at Ryan and McGee.
Samuel was raised by his older sister, who nurtured and protected him. She saw to his spiritual and moral upbringing as well. She explained away and helped hide some of his more antisocial behavior until it couldn't be hidden anymore. Samuel and I met shortly after I arrived at the agency. Isn't that true, Samuel?
Yes, doctor.
But eventually, they asked you to leave my program and be a part of another. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
It had an interesting, almost benign-sounding name. Do you recall what it was?
Samuel went mute.
Wise pretended to rack his brain.
Finally he said,
I remember now. Swim Club. That's what they called it. That's the group you were asked to join. The group your sister knows nothing about.
Silence.
She sacrificed so much to raise you, to protect you. She gave up any hope of a life of her own. But she believes you turned out to be a successful man. You take care of her now that she's had her stroke. You, what was it she believed you did for a living? It was something that sounded boring, but allowed you to travel.
I facilitate mining contracts.
Wise snapped his fingers.
That was it. She's very proud of you, isn't she? You are the only family each of you has. If she knew what you really did for a living, she would be devastated, wouldn't she? She would be incredibly disappointed, not only in you, but in herself, for allowing you to become what you have become.
Do you think she would see you as a monster, Samuel?
The man's face reddened again. He was angry.
Dr. Wise, please stop speaking about my sister. She has nothing to do with this.
I think you're wrong, Samuel. She has everything to do with this. She raised you. She lied and covered up for you. She knows what you are capable of. She knows she didn't get you the treatment you should have had a long, long time ago.
Why do you think that is? Did she think you would get better? Or had she covered up so many unspeakable things that she was tainted as well? An accomplice? Did you poison her chances at happiness, Samuel? Her chances for a normal life? Is that what caused her stroke? Holding all of those unspeakable things inside until something finally snapped in her as well?
The man leaned forward, every ropey fiber in his wide, muscular torso straining as the steel handcuffs dug into his wrists.
If you do not stop, Dr. Wise, he threatened, his voice trailing off.
If I don't stop what, Samuel? You'll retire me?
Samuel's eyes snapped up to meet his, and there was a flash of evil. He was completely changed, consumed with rage. A battle had been kicked off inside him, and he was quickly losing control. Wise could read it in his face, and over every square inch of his taut, coiled body, waiting to spring.
It would hurt your sister to know what you do. It would cause her great pain, wouldn't it?
The man's eyes shifted to the floor.
Like it or not, Samuel, she is a factor in this equation. But how she factors depends on you. Everything depends
on you.
When his body went almost limp and tears began to form at the corners of his eyes, Wise put his hand back on the man's shoulder to comfort him.
"It's going to be okay," he said.
And at that moment, he knew he was going to get everything he needed out of the killer known to so many as the Lamb, but whom he knew as a deeply disturbed, very sick man named Samuel, who was fighting to keep a spark of decency alive within the hurricane of his severely tortured soul.
Chapter 51. Boston, Massachusetts. It was going to be a long day, and Harvath had no intention of fueling it with police coffee. So Cordero took him to Café Vittoria on Hanover Street. Billed as the first Italian cafe in Boston, they were not yet open at this early hour, but there were signs of life, and Cordero told him not to worry. She tapped on the glass with her car key and caught the attention of an older man setting up inside. He smiled when he saw her and came over, unlocked the door, and let them in.
"The lovely Lara. So nice to see you," he said as he welcomed them in.
"The lovely Lara," Harvath repeated quietly.
"I've been here once or twice before."
"Okay," the man said as he stepped behind the counter. "What can I do for you, officers?"
"He's not an off—" Cordero began, but then decided to let it go. "What do you have that's hot and ready to go?"
With its tin ceiling, vintage espresso machines, antique grinders, and old black-and-white photographs, it was one of the most charming cafes Harvath had ever visited. If the character and ambiance were any indication, he was in for some pretty good coffee.
"Okay if I order for us?" Cordero asked.
Harvath nodded, and she placed the order. While the man behind the counter worked, he asked about what had happened a couple of blocks away over at Garden Court. To her credit, she played it vague while still making the man feel like he had an inside connection with an important Boston homicide detective. When the coffee was ready and paid for, the man told her to wait a minute, and he slipped several pastries into a paper bag and handed them to her.
"You don't have to do that," she said.
"For your partner."
Harvath began to put his hands up to say no thank you, but the man behind the counter said,
"Your other partner, the Italiano."
"You mean Sal," Cordero said with a smile.
"He only eats small children," Harvath interjected.
The female detective shook her head and removed a $10 bill.
"I'm sure he'll appreciate these. How much do I owe you?"
"Nothing. Free. Free," the man said.
"You were sweet to let us in early. Thank you. But I don't need a discount or anything for free. That's not how we do things."
The man didn't know how to respond. Finally, he said,
"Okay. $8.
Cordero handed him the 10 and told him to keep the rest as a tip. He thanked her and showed them outside, then locked the door behind them and got back to setting up for the day.
"Thanks for the coffee," Harvath said.
"You're welcome."
"I'm a little bit disappointed, though."
"You haven't even tried the coffee yet."
He smiled at her.
"Yesterday, you took me for breakfast where the Boston Strangler killed his last victim, and today, it's just a coffee bar."
"Just a coffee bar?" she replied, shaking her head.
"Shows what you know about Boston history, Mr. Expert. Trust me, you don't want to know about this one."
"I knew it," said Harvath, as he peeled the lid off his to-go cup and blew on his coffee.
"You homicide cops can't help yourselves. Like moths to a flame."
"I'm telling you, we're here for the coffee. Trust me."
"That's the second time you've asked me to trust you. Why?"
"Because there is a story attached to this building, and it's horrible."
"I'm a big boy," he said, turning around to study the building's brick facade. "What's the story?"
"Just remember," she said, relenting.
"You asked." "I take full responsibility."
"Okay. Do you know what a baby farm is?"
He'd heard of a baby factory before, but something told him this was different.
"No," he replied. "I don't think I know what that is. What are we talking about?"
"Back in the 1800s, women who got pregnant out of wedlock and who wanted to avoid the social stigma that came along with it would often place their infants in what was pejoratively called a baby farm. These baby farms could provide wet nurses and would take the child off the mother's hands for a limited time, or adopt the child altogether if the price was right,
The understanding was that the child would be cared for.
I'm guessing that wasn't the case in this instance.
There was a notorious baby farm right here in the late 1800s. The woman who ran it was named Mrs. Elwood, and she abused many of the children quite severely, and even murdered several of them.
Harvath grimaced.
The idea of babies being given up by their mothers was bad enough, but to think they were abused and even killed at the hands of people entrusted with their care turned his stomach. There was nothing lower in his book than someone who abused children or animals. The cafe's owners, she continued, opened a cigar bar in the basement that everyone said was haunted. They brought in some paranormal researchers who found a disgusting syringe from the 1870s that one of the ghosts allegedly drew their attention to. Once the syringe was taken out of the building, the haunting stopped.
"Do you believe in all that stuff?" Harvath asked, taking a sip of his coffee.
"Spirits? Ghosts? I don't know. I've seen some absolutely horrific crime scenes in my time, the last 2 days included. I suppose I can understand why some souls are unable to cross over. I'd like to think that if I got murdered, I'd be pissed off enough to stay around until the case got solved. But I'm stubborn like that. What about you?"
"If anyone tried to murder me, it wouldn't be unsolved, because I'd take them with me."
"Tough guy, huh?" she said.
"No," he replied. "Just stubborn like that, you know."
Cordero smiled and suggested that they get going. As they walked, she said, "It all makes me wonder."
"Wonder what?"
"What people will say 100 years from now, when they pass the murder scenes we're working?"
It was a good question. "Let's hope they say it was a tough case, but you and I figured it out as quickly as we could, and we stopped anyone else from being killed."
"Agreed," she said, as they reached her car, and she looked at her watch. "Let me tell you what I think we need to do."
Chapter 52.
"Damn right I'm not happy," Reed Carlton shouted into the phone at Harvath. "I don't care what kind of contacts Monroe Lewis and the Federal Reserve have. Part of what they are paying us for is to be their eyes and ears in this case. They should have heard about this from me, and I should have heard it right away from you. You were at the scene before the FBI, for Christ's sake."
"Sir, let me—"
Harvath attempted, but he was cut off.
"Be quiet and listen to me. I don't care if it's 3 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, midnight, twilight, firelight, whatever frickin' time it is. If there's a development in a case we're working on, especially a murder, I expect you to call me. Whether or not you're going to wake me up should never factor into it. Do you understand?"
The boss was fired up, and Harvath knew better than to respond in any fashion other than completely professional.
"Yes, sir," he said. "It's my fault. It won't happen again."
Harvath's phone had rung just as Cordero was dropping him back at his hotel. He had planned to shower and change while she went home to pick up her son and drop him off at daycare. They were going to meet back at her office. In between then, Harvath was going to call the old man and give him an update, but apparently Monroe Lewis had heard from the FBI first. There wasn't much Harvath could add to what the old man had been told, only his belief that the victim was Peter Whalen, the missing Fed chair candidate from Chicago. The information didn't make the old man happy. Not that Harvath had expected it to. He wasn't happy either. Quite the contrary. They had been hired to try to help save 4 people, and half of them were now dead.
"So besides another dinner and maybe some dancing with this female detective you're playing footsie with," the old man stated, "do you have any plans to actually solve this case? Or should I expect to read about it when you get around to sending me a postcard?"
Carlton was one of the most brilliant people Harvath knew, but he could be a real curmudgeon when he was pissed off. In those instances, it was a free fire zone for his acerbic tongue. The only thing he could do was bite his own tongue and wait for the storm to pass.
"The bureau guys at the scene are proceeding on the assumption that the remaining 2 missing Fed candidates are here in Boston," said Harvath, "and we agree."
"We?"
"Detective Cordero and I."
"So what are they planning on doing about it?"
"They're going to go public with the names and photos of the last 2 missing persons. Their hope is that maybe somebody in Boston has seen something and will provide actionable intelligence."
"Are they going to publicize the Fed connection as well?"
"No," Harvath replied.
It sounds like they're going to do a straight missing persons, believed to be in the Boston area approach.
That should keep it out of the national media for a bit longer, said Carlton, but not much.
Lewis and the Fed have been on borrowed time anyway. The only reason all the missing persons haven't been linked together is that nobody really knows who they are.
And the newest murder?
Boston PD has the scene locked down pretty tight. Because of the smoke and the fire trucks, they're going to allow people to assume there was a fire. They're not taking the body out in a body bag. They're going to drain the gang box and transport it with a corpse down to the ME's office.
How are they planning on putting the word out regarding the last two missing candidates?
If they hustle, they can get it included in the morning police roll call briefings. All the detectives and all the patrol officers will be given the names and photos, along with a brief description and as much of the story as the FBI decides they want put out there. I think they're going to connect it to the other murders.
Then you can speed up the timetable of the national press getting the story, said the old man. Police departments leak like sieves.
Hopefully they'll keep it under wraps.
What about beyond the PD?
Names and photographs of Betsy Mitchell and Jonathan Renner will run on local television news, along with the FBI's 1-800 number for tips. The names and photographs are also going to the local papers.
Better late than never, Carlton said.
With detectives and patrol officers out there beating the bushes, along with the public keeping their eyes open, we may get lucky.
I hope it works.
Me too, said Harbath. I'm going to get cleaned up and then get back down to police headquarters. Is there anything else you need?
Yeah, the client wants to speak with you.
Monroe Lewis? What for?
He wants an update from the field.
I just gave you one.
I know, said the old man. And even though he just spoke with the FBI, he wants to hear from you, too. He asked me for your cell phone number, and I told him I'd give it to him after you and I spoke. Keep it short and keep it limited to the facts. Understood?
Yes, sir.
Chapter 53.
The call with Monroe Lewis turned out to be a call not only with Lewis, but also with William Jacobson, the Fed's head of security. While Lewis wanted Harvath's overall thoughts and impressions of where the case was going and why they hadn't developed any leads, Jacobson grilled Harvath for exacting and excruciatingly specific details. They were getting ready for the media firestorm they knew was on its way. Finally, Lewis resignedly asked,
"There's not going to be any ransom demand, is there?"
"No," Harvath replied. "I don't think there will be. Not unless going public spooks whoever's involved."
Lewis knew the Fed better than anyone else. He had risen to his position by dedicating his life to the organization. He had no family, no significant other. He could be found there nights and weekends. He knew that many saw him as cold and distant. He also knew that when he tried to be more convivial, it often came off as phony. Chairman Sawyer had been the first person to take a deep personal interest in him. Sawyer had become his mentor and had helped orchestrate his promotion to where he was now. He had confided many things in Lewis, and it had been a particular shock when Sawyer suddenly died. Lewis had been forced to come to grips very quickly with what was important not only for the Fed, but also for his own career. None of it was easy, and the course they were charting was fraught with peril. "You think it's possible to spook these people?" asked Jacobson. "After what they've done?"
"I don't know."
"What do you think the odds are of catching them?"
"I have to be honest with you," said Harvath,
knowing full well the old man would hate him for saying this.
"I don't think the odds are very good, not unless we catch some sort of a break. But that's exactly what you hope for in a case like this."
"You're right," said Lewis. "We have to remain positive. We've got to do everything we can to solve this thing."
"As far as we know, the last two are still alive."
"John and Betsy," he said, distraught.
"I'm going to do everything I can to find them."
"Please do, Mr. Harvath, and make sure to keep us abreast of everything that's happening."
"We will."
After hanging up, Harvath showered, changed, and then picked up another coffee in the lobby. It was just under 2 miles to 1 Schroeder Plaza and police headquarters. Rush hour was in full swing, and there were already several people lined up for taxis, so he decided to walk it. The fresh air and uninterrupted time to think would both do him good. He was bothered by how little he'd been able to develop in the way of actionable leads. Granted, He had been on the case less than 48 hours, but so much had happened. He had never believed in the perfect crime. There was no such thing. Criminals always left clues. Always. That said, even the prints they'd been able to recover had been a bust. Their killer was a ghost. What was worse, Harvath was relegated to playing catch-up. He wasn't even on defense, fending off an attack. It was like being blindfolded and shoved in a dark room with 50 people wielding bats. You knew you were going to be hit. You just had no idea where the next blow was going to come from. As he walked, he tried to sort through the facts of the case. The Federal Reserve chairman had died from heart failure just over a week ago. Days later, the top five candidates to replace him had been abducted. That was Sunday. Today was Wednesday. And in between, a woman named Claire Marquardt, a man named Herman Penning, and another man named Peter Whalen had all been brutally murdered. Despite knowing the approximate times of day and the areas he had passed through, neither the police nor the FBI had been able to catch the killer on a single CCTV camera. It was as if cameras couldn't capture his image, like he was some sort of vampire whose reflection was never cast in a mirror. Whoever the killer was, he was exceptionally skilled. Which brought Harvath to Bill Wise, and the idea that the man they were looking for was highly trained, possibly even created by the CIA. He certainly wasn't operating alone, but the idea that agency personnel could be behind something like this was almost too much for Harvath to swallow. There was, though, more than one person at work here, and whoever they were, they felt justified in committing murder. It was all Harvath needed to know about them. It helped frame how he would deal with them if he got the chance. When Harvath arrived at police headquarters, Cordero was already upstairs in her office. "This just went out," she said, handing him the police bulletin on their last two missing persons. Harvath read it over and handed it back. "The Federal Reserve," she said. "That's what they were all being considered ahead, isn't it?" He nodded. "How'd you figure it out?" "If you hadn't told me about Claire Marquardt, I might not have. But when you combine her background in economics and banking with the death of the recent Fed chairman and what I learned from a 5-minute web search about Jekyll Island, it doesn't take a detective to put it all together."
"I didn't tell you about Jekyll specifically, though."
"No. You said an island off the coast of Georgia. One of the FBI agents mentioned it by name this morning." Changing tack, she said, "You could have told me that this was about the Fed."
"I know. I'm sorry. Orders."
Looking at his watch, he asked,
"Did the bulletin on Renner and Mitchell make it in time to be included in the morning roll calls?"
"It did. What do you think our next move should be?"
"Well, short of going back to church and lighting a candle, there's only one thing I can think of to do."
"What's that?"
Harvath took a deep breath and exhaled.
"We map out every major historical location in Boston and try to figure out where he's going to strike next."
Chapter 54. Betsy Mitchell had tried all the tricks she knew in order to stay calm. The conditions under which she had been kept were terrible. She didn't remember much from her abduction. She had been on her way back home from having dinner with friends. There'd been an accident. She had stopped to help. The rest was a blur. Whoever had kidnapped her must have drugged her, too. She had been kept in some sort of a crate, like a large dog kennel. It was dark most of the time, and she was wearing restraints. Every once in a while, a small panel opened in the top, and a water bottle and power bars were thrown in. She had not been allowed out to exercise or use the facilities. She figured out fairly quickly that was why the plastic bags had been left in the crate. Despite having double and triple bagged her waist, the crate smelled putrid. She could only imagine what she smelled and looked like at this point. Though she'd been drugged, she remembered the splitting pain in her ears. She had never done well equalizing pressure when flying, and normally wore custom earplugs that helped her avoid barotraumas. Wherever they had transported her, they had made multiple stops along the way. When they had reached their destination, the crate had been placed inside some sort of a truck. It had been a diesel vehicle. She could tell by the sound of the engine and the smell of the fumes.
The truck had driven for some time until it finally ended up where she was now. Without a watch or any natural light with which to mark the passage of time, she had no idea what day it was or how long she had been gone. Surely people were looking for her by now. Hopefully they had started looking when she didn't show up for work Monday morning. The CEO of a successful hedge fund didn't just go missing without people noticing. More than once during her ordeal, she had chastised herself for not taking her board up on its suggestion that she have bodyguards. She'd always thought the idea ridiculous. If she were a Bill Gates or a Warren Buffett, she might have considered it, but she was Betsy Mitchell. She was an approachable, popular cause-promoting finance guru. People didn't want to harm her, they wanted to hug her. Besides, she used to joke, when was the last time you ever heard of an American executive being kidnapped in the United States? When knowledgeable people ran the stats down for her, she'd laugh them off. Betsy Mitchell was all about budgets and bottom lines, not bodyguards. Until, that is, she was taken. As little as she knew about being kidnapped, she did know that if your kidnappers hid their faces, that was a good sign. It meant that you would be free at some point, and they didn't want you to be able to identify them. When the door to her crate was opened, she found the sight of the powerfully built man crouched on his haunches with a green glow stick jarring. He wore coveralls and a smiling Guy Fawkes mask, the kind popular in anti-capitalist movements. Though the mask was unsettling, its choice told her something about the people who had taken her. If they had done their homework into who she was, which they very likely had, they would know that she supported many popular causes likely aligned with theirs. Whatever their beef, she was not their enemy. She had simply been chosen because her company would pay to get her back. It was an easy score. In desperate economic times, people turned to desperate measures. She hoped that they understood that she appreciated their struggle. Under different circumstances, she might have even freely contributed to whatever their cause was. That made little difference now. She was their prisoner. And while the tough businesswoman in her wanted to see if she could talk them into letting her go, there was something about the eyes behind the mask that shook her self-preservation instinct to the core and told her to keep her mouth shut and do what she was told. He beckoned her out of the cage with his gloved hand. She did as she was instructed. In the corners of the room, he had placed other chemical lights, which cast the space in an eerie green pall. It was difficult to tell where she was. The space was dirty and industrial, constructed of brick and concrete. As she neared the front of the cage, he grabbed a fistful of her thick brown hair and twisted so hard she could hear her scalp begin to pop as it tore away. She screamed, and he struck her across the face with a glow stick. He slammed her face against the floor and then slid something underneath her neck. She had no idea what it was until he let go of her hair, and she could feel him fumbling with a buckle of some sort. She was being fitted with a collar. Why? Was he trying to humiliate her? Were they going to make some sort of a video to send with their ransom demand? There were a million questions flying through her mind, not one of which she dared to ask. The side of her face where she had been struck with the glow stick still hurt. She had no desire to incur the man's wrath any further. For right now, she would keep her questions to herself. Whoever this man was, he meant business. Inside the cage, she had been free to move around, but now, once the collar was attached, the man jerked her the rest of the way out and restrained her hands behind her back again. Her legs, though, were left alone. This brought even more questions to her mind, most too hideous even to contemplate, and she tried to block all of them out. She would know the man's intent soon enough. After being cooped up in the cramped cage, her legs were sore and her joints stiff. She had trouble walking, and this angered the man in the Guy Fawkes mask, who had to half-drag her to the far side of the room, where a metal ring had been bolted into the wall. There was a length of chain hanging from it, which he then affixed to her collar. With her hands secured behind her back, there was no possible way she could free herself. She was able to at least stand and move around a little bit, and it felt good to be on her feet again once more and no longer folded up inside the fetid metal box. The man in the mask stood back and stared at her, a
assessing her. Slowly he put his hands out in front of himself and began doing calisthenics. He started with squats, and he motioned for her to follow suit. He was encouraging her to limber up. Why? Were they letting her go? The thought was too good to be true. But instead of banishing it from her mind, she embraced it. They are going to let me go. She repeated the thought over and over again in her mind. Once she had gone through the series of exercises, the man in the mask removed what looked like a small digital audio recorder. He held it out so she could see it clearly, and he activated its play button. The male voice that came from the speaker was upbeat and dramatic, as it over-accentuated its words.
"Please, repeat after me," it said. "Lucy Lockett lost her pocket. Sally Fisher found it. Not a penny was there in it, just a ribbon round it."
She had no idea what bizarre game the man in the mask was playing at. Her silence aggravated him. Rewinding the message, he forcefully extended the recorder out to her and played it again.
"Please, repeat after me," the digital voice said. "Lucy Lockett lost her pocket. Sally Fisher found it. Not a penny was there in it, just a ribbon round it."
She was understandably scared, and her mind wasn't working as well as it normally did.
"Sally Fisher lost her locket," she stammered.
Drawing his free hand back, the man in the mask struck her across the face again. He rewound the message and thrust the recorder at her once more.